Hey kids, you can hear me pretty good? This is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast.
What's the deal with my brain? Why am I so obviously insane? In a perfect situation,
and
let love down the drain.
I've got a story for you, I'll let you know in just a second what it is. Was just driving. I didn't bring my recorder. And so the whole time I was thinking, gosh, I wish I had something to record on, because it would be fun to do a Rish Outcast right now. And I filled up my phone's voice memo folder. I filled up the whole phone, really. But, with the memory gone, I can't really record anything else. Which is no big deal, I guess. Somebody I was talking to the other day, it might even have been Big, said that his phone doesn't even have a voice memo feature, so it can always be worse, kids. As the great Adam Carolla once said, hell has a basement. I have decided I'm going to do a story today. And it's been a long time coming. It may still be a really bad idea to do this story. The story I'm going to present for you today is The Brown Prom, written by Mr. Rish Outfield. I don't know how much background you need on this thing. This is a story, a high school-centric story, written about my youth. Around the turn of the century, when I first moved to California, and I didn't really know anybody, I started to romanticize the past, especially my teenagehood. And I wrote a story or two about that time period. And I loved doing it. It was a way of revisiting the past and reformatting it, retelling it, remaking it sometimes, so that things happen differently in the story than they did in real life. And this is a story based in truth. I mean, not a lot of it is true, just the most important aspect of it. Gosh, I've got a lot to say. So let me just run the story, and then you can let me run my mouth on the way on the other side. If you can, enjoy it. Stephen King, in his 1974 debut novel, Carrie, wrote about a hellish tragedy at a high school dance. If you've seen the 1976 Brian De Palma film, or its many parodies, including the 2002 TV movie, you know what occurred there. The survivors in the book and the media referred to the incident as The Black Prom. My name is Anthony Peterson, Tony to friends. I grew up in Pingo, Utah, and graduated from Praiseden High School in 2007. When my friends and I talk about what we experienced in April of 2006, we sometimes refer to it as The Brown Prom. It's not a horror story like Stephen King's, but it has its twists, its romance, and tragedy of its own. The Brown Prom. Here in your arms, when everything seems to be clear, not a solitary thing do I fear, except when this moment comes near the dancing's end. Sting. I was overjoyed at the prospect of going to the prom with Brooke McDaniels. Who wouldn't be? She was, bar none, the hottest girl in the sophomore class, turning heads in the concert choir, the student council, and of course, the good old cheerleading squad. I'd had a crush on her since I first saw her, going from class to random class, delivering copies for newspaper staff. Her gorgeous, thick brown hair, naturally curly, but easily straightened. Her big, bright, innocent blue eyes. A round button nose like a little girl's.
and a smile that would make a dentist weak in the knees. And she was going to be my date to the junior prom. Now, don't get me wrong. I held no illusions. It was just one date. And just a lucky circumstance that my pal Jane let me know Brooke was newly boyfriendless right around the time I was trying to figure out who to ask.
"Why not ask your beloved? Live a little, eh, Tony?"
Jane asked me in our music appreciation class. I didn't really like music appreciation, though the teacher, Conrad Alper, was a cool guy. Mostly I just spent the class doodling and chatting quietly with Jane, a tall, too thin girl with hair so blonde it almost seemed white. Jane was great, a senior all into goth fashion and attitude, who, I know how this sounds, had religious studies class with Brooke and heard the whole sordid thing. Apparently, Whitley Chittister, Brooke's steady boyfriend since I'd met her, had been mean to her, which in Praiseden, Utah, could mean anything from calling her stupid to kicking her out of his truck. Details were rare, but the bottom line was that they were broken up. And that meant, well, some lucky PHS student was going to take her to the prom. Like Jane suggested, why not me? After all, I had been crazy about her since the second time I'd laid eyes on her. The first time, in case you're wondering, she had been a 13-year-old with braces and the dimensions of an 8-year-old. We'd done children's theater together, Cinderella, and I'd been the king, and she'd been one of the mice. But those days were gone, and she was definitely the Cinderella type now. At first, I doubted my chances. I'm fairly short, fairly plain-looking, with sandy blonde hair and freckles around my nose. The darn things have dogged me since the second grade. I was somewhat popular, at least people knew who I was, but hadn't had a real girlfriend since Becca Chatsworth let me put my tongue in her ear at the Valentine's dance in junior high. Certainly Brooke would get better offers. But I was sure she wouldn't get any earlier offers if I was on the ball. And Brooke was the type of high-class lady, if a 16-year-old can be considered a lady, and I think she can, who wouldn't turn down a decent boy who got there first. A bunch of us killed the last quarter of Mr. Alper's music appreciation class by chatting about our prom plans. Nick Fisher said he'd ask that nameless, super quiet girl with all the hair. He wasn't taking it too seriously, but Jane suggested he take her instead. After all, they were both seniors and wanted to hit the prom just to say they did. It didn't look like romance would bloom there. Cheryl Bradford was going with, big surprise, her boyfriend James. Third prom in a row. I wondered if James could somehow get out of taking pictures this time. But it would be fatal for a guy to ask that. Carlos Precio was as excited as I was. He and Lydia Sprague were in love. And this was their first prom as a couple. Dorky Daniel Potter wasn't going. Said prom was for Molly Ringwald and gay dudes. But I knew he hadn't been able to get a date. Poor bastard. I could go into detail about how extravagantly each guy asked his girl. Seems in Praiseden that's the thing to do, but I'll just tell you how I asked Brooke. My best friend Errol had worked at McDonald's his sophomore year, and most of the last summer. He still had friends there, and the two of us went by practically every day for snacks, full meals, and occasionally just cups of ice water. I was able to use Errol's contacts to set up Brooke's invitation to prom. Errol had a girlfriend, Jennifer Cassaday, and had asked her to the prom by sneaking to her driveway at 1 a.m., writing a message with a paintbrush and a mason jar of gasoline, and then called her cell phone when it was ready.
"Check your driveway, Jennifer,"
he intoned in a low and ominous voice. Of course, his number had shown up on her phone when she answered it, but he hadn't considered that. Then he lit the message aflame, which read, "Jenny, will you go to prom with me, Errol?" But because the gasoline ran down the driveway a bit when he wrote it, looked more like, "Remy, will you go to prom with me, Ebu?" Errol had ran down the street as soon as he lit the match, where I was waiting in the getaway car, my mother's Jetta. Jennifer had certainly found the invite original, but her parents, who had also come out to investigate, were not amused. She'd had to talk her father out of calling the police and told him Errol would apologize for it before prom night. Errol hadn't yet done so, and I didn't think he would. She'd be going with him either way. Brooke McDaniel's invitation had been stranger. She had come out to her car after school to find several balloons with the golden arches on them, used for children's birthdays, apparently, tied around the car, and a letter in a McDonald's gift certificate envelope with the message, "Brooke, you are the fairest maiden in McDonaldland. All the Fry girls are jealous of you. Ronald McDonald himself wishes to make you an invitation, but you will have to go to his domain to hear it. Head to the McDonald's on Main Street today before closing and pull to the drive-thru. Ask to speak to Ronald. Your pal, Grimace." I didn't see it happen, but Errol's friend, Mandy Cass, who worked the drive-thru, told us what occurred. Apparently, at 6:15 that evening, a car pulled up, and when Mandy said, "Welcome to Praiston McDonald's, can I take your order?" a hesitant female voice said,
Yes, I was wondering if Ronald was in?"
Mandy had been forced to hit mute on her speaker as the guy who was heading the kitchen and had a headset to listen to drive-thru orders had shouted, "She's here, you guys!" much louder than necessary. Mandy knew Brooke fairly well and couldn't resist saying,
"Ronald? Ronald who?"
There was silence for a moment before Brooke answered,
"Ronald McDonald."
Mandy hit mute again to cover a giggle, then told her,
"You mean the clown from the commercials? I'm sorry to tell you this, but he's not real."
Brooke went silent again, and Mandy had felt sorry for her, though she had intended to torture her a great deal when she arrived. Instead, Mandy pushed the intercom at her belt and inquired,
"Hey, your name isn't Brooke, is it?"
"Yes."
"Oh, I apologize. Ronald had to leave, but he left something for you."
Once again, Brooke hesitated. Cheerleader or not, she really was a nice girl.
"What is it?" "Just pull up to the second window."
Brooke drove her Suzuki Samurai around the bend and past Mandy, who was at the first window.
"Mandy?"
she asked, not even aware that the senior worked at McDonald's.
"You're in on this?"
"Second window, please,"
Mandy Cass said, pretending not to know Brooke from Adam.
"Who is it?"
Brooke asked her. Mandy smiled down at her, feigning empty-headedness.
"I was told to say, if you ask that question, that I don't know, and yes, you're very pretty."
Now Brooke smiled too, and it's probably best that I wasn't there as a witness. If I, Sir Anthony Peterson, had seen her then, I might have literally swooned.
"I'll get you for this,"
Brooke said, then pulled up to the second window, where an employee she didn't know, Errol's second cousin Stephen, had a happy meal for her, complete with small Sprite.
"This is from Ronald, miss."
She took the box and drink, setting them down in her passenger seat.
"You have a nice day,"
Stephen told her. She couldn't help herself and asked him if he knew who it was from. Stephen told her the same thing Mandy had, blushing when he got to the pretty part. Brooke drove off, and nobody saw her open the package and find part one of the message on an index card stuck in the French fry sleeve.
1. Brooke, Ronald is sorry to say that he cannot go to the prom with you.
Part 2 in between the plain buns of the hamburger.
2. As he is already going with Wendy from Wendy's, although you are much prettier.
And part 3, artfully hidden in a Ziploc bag under the ice and Sprite of her drink cup.
3. Will you go with Tony Peterson instead?
Whether she thought it was clever and cute or not, she was quick with her reply. As I've mentioned, Brooke McDaniels was lovely, possessed long curly hair, and a pleasing shape, so it wouldn't have been necessary for her to answer me in a creative way. She could have simply told me yes at school the next day, or even called me on the phone if she was that lethargic. She couldn't, however, tell me no, partly due to her being a genuine lady, as yes, I have already mentioned, but mostly due to Mandy Cass and Stephen Van Nostrum and Joey Rodriguez, the fry cook, and Alex Hanover, the kitchen head, not to mention Errol Bryant, who told everyone they knew about my somewhat unique invitation. It spread like wildfire, amusing everyone that heard it. Indeed, the only flaw in my play seemed to be not having somebody videotape the drive-through exchange. I wish I'd thought of that. Brooke had been flattered, I later learned, and had no real problem with the idea of Toni Petersson as her prom date. In fact, when she told her dad about breaking up with her boyfriend, he told her to dry her tears, that the guys would be lining up to ask her to the prom, even at that late date. I guess Mr. McDaniels had laughed about my clever way of asking her out and told her he fully supported me, even though we'd never met. For a guy who put no thought into the invite was clearly instead focusing his schemes on getting into his prom date's pants. I didn't find out until more than a year later, my last week at PHS it was, that Brooke liked me well enough, not necessarily romantically, though I was cute in a timid way, quote unquote. She thought I was nice and honest, and she never forgot how I told her at our junior high Halloween party that I'd always suspected she was an angel, but now I had the proof. She never bothered to correct me that she was supposed to be a fairy, not an angel. Brooke's first idea was to get a plastic ball, write yes on it, and hide it among the balls in the McDonald's playland. But, like every Praisedon resident, she knew of the urban legend that drugs were dealt out of the playland, and a horrified parent had found an empty syringe in there one time. All untrue, of course, though the horrified parent had found a soiled diaper in the ball pit one time. Her second idea had been to have a pizza delivered to me, either at home or in class, and have her written response on the bottom of the box, under the pizza. But that had been done. In fact, it was similar to how Jennifer Cassaday had told Errol Bryant she'd go, though that had been a box of donuts, not pizza. And she wanted to make more of a puzzle of it all. And that's exactly what she did. She drove to the Shopko in Miller's Fork and found a 30-piece puzzle with Kim Possible on it. Unfortunately, they didn't sell Ronald McDonald puzzles at Shopko. She put it together, grateful she'd not bought the 100-piece Yu-Gi-Oh! Puzzle, turned it over, and wrote this on it with a black Sharpie.
Toni, I would be happy to go to the prom with you. I'm glad Ronald had another date. I like you better. Brooke.
She then broke up the puzzle and had a friend find out what locker was mine, then stick all the pieces into the grate at the bottom. It was made all the better when I, already late for third period, had to spend 2 minutes picking up the puzzle pieces that had covered the floor when I wrenched the locker open. So, the date was set. Brooke and I would be going with Errol and Jennifer in Errol's van. We'd go to a nice restaurant in Provo, then on to the dance. Errol convinced me that we ought to rent gray tuxedos, since everyone else would be in black, and could get ties and cummerbunds that matched the dresses our respective dates wore. Oh, it would be so grand. Brooke had a sparkly blue dress. Midnight blue, she said it was. When I asked her if I could get a picture of it to match my tie to, she said she'd do me one better and get me a swatch of it.
If it's no problem,
I said, already planning on putting it in a future scrapbook. We were talking on the phone, but my palms were sweating anyway.
None at all, she said. I'm almost done.
Done what?
Sewing the dress.
I felt my eyebrows going way up.
You made your dress to the prom?
Yep, Brooke said. I haven't bought one since 8th grade.
I was both impressed and shocked. She hadn't seemed poor.
I enjoy sewing for some reason,
she told me.
You'll like it, really.
That seemed a pretty safe bet. We chatted for a moment longer, then I hung up. I was almost delirious with fanciful anticipation.
It turned out Jennifer Cassaday's dress was cream-colored, a store-bought prom dress, this one, and it sort of made Errol's gray tux look silly. So at the last minute, Errol switched to a black tuxedo, and I was stuck with my gray. Word had spread through PHS that I was taking Brooke McDaniels to the prom. Reactions ranged from amazed to jealous, dubious to jealous, envious to oddly hostile. People seemed to recognize that she was only going with me because she'd broken up with Whitley Chittister. Carlos Precio even called it a mercy date. But some of the guys claimed they thought I actually had a chance with her. In the days leading up to the prom, my mind had a hard time concentrating on my studies. There was a term project coming up in music appreciation, an easy A otherwise, and I hadn't even thought of a subject, even though we were to have handed in our proposals on Monday. I saw Nick Fisher at his usual spot at the front of the room, leafing through a Philip Dick book. I noticed he was merely skimming it, turning two or three pages at a time. "Hey, Nick," I said.
"Hey,"
he said, turning another page.
"Nick, what's your paper on?"
He looked up.
"What?"
"The term paper? What are you doing it on?"
"Oh," he said, apparently distracted himself.
"I'm going to, write a line-by-line interpretation of a classic song."
"Good idea,"
I said.
"Thanks. I just thought of it."
That didn't make sense, but he was super smart, and I thought I'd copy his idea.
"Mind if I do the same?"
"What?" "Oh, sure. What song will you do?"
I don't know. How about you?"
"I'm trying to decide. You know that Beatles song that goes yellow custard dripping from a dead dog's eye?"
"Gross, no. That's a Beatles song?"
"I always wondered where that came from. Maybe I'll do that."
I figured he was yanking my chain at that point, but it gave me an idea. My cousins and I used to argue over whether Pearl Jam's Jeremy kills his classmates or himself in that famous 90s song.
"Can I do Pearl Jam?" I asked.
"You're asking me? Do whatever you like."
"Thanks," I said.
The prom was on Saturday, and on Friday during lunch, Brooke approached me at my locker.
"Oh no," I thought. "She got back together with Whitley Chittister. She's here to tell me she's going with him instead."
But Brooke just wanted to finalize everything, make sure she knew the plan.
"So I can tell my mom and dad,"
she said, whatever that meant.
I think we're picking you up."
"Around?"
"Around your house, I guess."
"No, I mean around what time?"
"Oh, I'm 4.
I guess we'll get you around 4:30. "Sounds good. Are we going to be in our prom outfits, or will we change after dinner?"
I didn't know. This was a lot of stuff to consider all of a sudden.
Prom outfits?
"Do you know?"
she asked, blinking several times. I didn't. Hadn't even considered it.
"Yeah, but I'll talk to Errol just to make sure. I'll call you if he says different."
"Okay."
"Okay."
"Looking forward to it."
"You are?"
I started to say, then snorted it back and said,
"Yeah, me too."
After school, Errol told me he had some big news. He had booked a hotel room in East Bay for after prom. I started to ask him what for, then my mind began to reel. Wow, that was big news. He looked proud of himself.
"Pretty cool, huh?"
"Are you going to mention this to Jennifer?"
The proud look continued.
"Oh, I'll mention it when the time is right."
But I knew how Jennifer could be, and reasonable wasn't it.
"And what if the time is never right?"
Errol didn't bat an eye.
"It will be. Trust me."
I could only marvel. While I wasn't thrilled with his choice of girlfriend, I was impressed that he was going to get some. Not jealous, exactly,
but hey, pretty in awe. So, you want me to pick you up one? Errol asked.
One what?
A Jennifer Cassaday, he jeered. A motel room, you retard.
What? For me?
For you and your date, sicko. You never know. I shook my head, amused, but realistic.
Well, yeah,
I know. Errol went to punch me in the stomach, then brought his fist up to my chin. Make it happen, Tony. If only it were that easy. Errol picked me up first. We both lived in Pingo, a teeny, so small I can't use the word tiny, I have to use the word teeny, town 15 miles south of Praesden, where both our dates lived. My mom took a picture of the two of us. She tried her darndest to get me to commit to bringing Brooke around for another picture, but I bravely defeated that proposition. We got to her house at 4:20. I considered asking Errol to drive around the block, but gas prices being what they were. He parked right in the driveway of the cute little white house that seemed like the sort of place a princess would live, if she were in hiding from the evil queen, and her roommates were dwarves. I had trouble swallowing as I stood on her porch and rang her doorbell. I didn't know what I was so afraid of. I had gone on dates before, but never to the junior prom, and never with Brooke McDaniels. Her little brother answered the door, probably 11 or so, took one look at me and smirked. I began,
Brooke, what kind of car do you have?
He asked me, looking past to the driveway.
Me?
The boy shook his head.
What, no limo?
Just the van.
Weak,
he said.
Worked for the Partridge family,
I said cheerfully, then regretted my statement. Either he wouldn't get the reference and think I was terribly lame, or he would recognize the reference and know I was terribly lame.
Is your sister ready?
The boy turned and shouted Brooke's name in a way that felt well practiced. I found my palms sweating again and had to switch the corsage to my armpit while I wiped them on the back of my tuxedo trousers. A moment later, a thick, rosy-faced man with receding brown hair and gray temples like Reed Richards came to the door. He scrutinized me, much like his son had, then eyed the corsage box under my arm. His face was not easily readable.
So, you're Mr. Peterson, he said.
No, that would be my dad, I responded, trying to stay cheerful.
Why don't you come inside?
Why didn't I? Because I was nervous enough as it was? Because I didn't want, and wasn't ready for, the third degree? Because I'd feel more comfortable going into Count Dracula's house?
Okay,
I said, but I glanced back at the van.
Is Brooke ready to leave?
Brooke's fine, Mr. McDaniel said. Let's talk for a second.
I obeyed, following him into the foyer of the house. It was large and nice, with spotless white walls and cream-colored carpet you wouldn't dare wear your shoes on. There were pictures and trophies and diplomas and awards in a big display case next to the couch. Mr. McDaniels gave me a second to look around the living room, then stepped close to me. He smelled like peppermint. Not the candy, but the plant. He leaned in, straightening my tie.
I have three daughters, Mr. Peterson. Brooke's the last one, so naturally, I'm a little protective.
Naturally, I tried to say, but it didn't come out very loud.
Prom night has always been magical for the girls. Romantic, classy, ending before it's worn out its welcome.
He paused then, as if to see if I'd catch his drift. I didn't until about half an hour later.
They look back on that night with fondness. Angelica even married the boy who took her to prom.
I didn't know where any of this was going,
Angelica's Brooke's sister?
Of course. His teeth approximated a smile. So, it's an important night. And Brooke tells me you're quite the gentleman. I couldn't respond to that, so I didn't. That's just about the highest compliment a young man can get, in my opinion. I thought it didn't hold a candle to handsome, cool, or well-hung, but again I said nothing. Now, I don't know how excited you are about tonight, but the prom means a lot to her. If I were you, I'd do everything I could to make tonight something special. Something to look back on and not want to change a thing. Sounded good. I couldn't have said it better myself. She only gets one junior prom.
Now, that wasn't true, since Brooke was actually only a sophomore and would surely be asked in 2007 and 2008. But again, I nodded. I'll do my best, sir, I said, though I called no one sir.
Who did?
You can count on me.
He put out his hand. I wiped my own on my butt and shook hands with the man. Surprisingly, his hand felt sweaty too. Here's Brooke, he said. As if on cue, she stepped out of the kitchen.
To say Brooke looked beautiful is pretty unnecessary. She had curled her hair in a way that I hadn't seen before, and she wore eyeshadow with glitter on it. The blue dress she had told me about was modest and almost floor length, but it showed off her figure, her smooth arms, and just the sweetest hint of breast. Its color also made her eyes stand out, like they had been replaced by blue neon. She'd painted her nails to match, and she smelled nice, too. She gave her father a quick kiss and said,
"Bye. Don't wait up, Papa."
I found it strange that she called him Papa, but hey, that's what Belle in Beauty and the Beast called her father, too.
"You know I will, anyway."
She rolled her eyes.
"Yeah, well."
We went out into the cool April evening. Errol drove. Jennifer sat in the passenger seat. Brooke and I sat together on the seat in the middle. We drove from Praisedon up to Provo for dinner. We had chosen a new Mexican restaurant. Jennifer said her parents went there the other night for their anniversary and raved about it, called Pescado Original. They specialized in fish and vegetarian dinners, but still had the expected burritos and enchiladas. Our meal was fairly uneventful. We were served by a heavy-set, perspiring Mexican woman. She was very affectionate, raving over our tuxedos and dresses as though she were our maiden aunt, or at least a nosy neighbor. Errol pointed out that chalupas were on the menu. Besides thinking that Taco Bell had made up the term, he suggested that a chalupa was what he was going to get from his prom date that night. Though Jennifer asked dumbly,
"You think we'll be hungry again?"
Both Brooke and I got it. I went a wee bit red, and would have elbowed my friend had Brooke not giggled at the comment. Still, I hoped he wouldn't continue to bring up sex or mention the motel key he procured. I didn't want Brooke to feel even 1% uncomfortable that night. Brooke saw gorditas on the menu and tried to put into practice her 2 years of high school Spanish. She thought that the word meant fat woman, but that couldn't be right, especially considering who our waitress was. We were told that the restaurant's speciality, for which they were world famous, was their fish burritos. I had never tried one, but Jennifer said they were really good. Brooke agreed, and Errol and I went along for the ride. If we didn't like them, we could always fill up on chips and salsa. Did I mention that dinner was unremarkable? What I mean to say was that not much happened there for me to go over in detail. We talked, laughed a little, and some of my jitters faded. Brooke was warm and as comfortable with the three of us as though we had always been friends. She even regaled them with a story of how, in our childhood Cinderella performance, I had torn my robe during the performance, bringing the play to an embarrassed halt.
I think that actually happened in a rehearsal. And I hadn't torn it, but just tripped up on it and pulled it off. But I was really flattered she remembered me at all from back then. When we left the restaurant, it was full dark, and as lovely an April night as any sailor, lover, or meteorologist could wish for. I started to think that maybe my rational mind, the one reminding me I didn't stand a chance with Brooke McDaniels, was wrong, and that my romantic mind, the one raised on my sister's Jane Austen novels and Disney films, was the right one. The change in the air between Brooke and me was palpable. No longer were her blue eyes wandering, but when I'd look at her, they'd be upon me, clear and bright. When I got into the van next to her, my hand aimlessly brushing against the fabric of her dress, she caught it up, her fingers entwining mine. How warm and soft her hand was, more fragile and girl-like than my mother's. As we drove along, she seemed to lean into me, her shoulder against my shoulder, her hair near my neck. My heartbeat raced, but I did not sweat. I did not feel nervous. I simply went with it, happy with these circumstances, but unwilling to force anything. We arrived at the dance. It was in the gymnasium, that familiar greasy smell in the air. But everything looked new and magical around us. The theme that year was Fairy Tales Come True, and it had been decorated to look like the England of yesteryear, with spires and triangular flags, human-like trees, and crisscrossing rainbows. Coldplay's Till Kingdom Come was just ending, and I hoped the music would continue in that vein. No guy could strike out to Coldplay, Moby, or Dido, and that was a fact. But as soon as it faded, My Humps by the Black Eyed Peas started up. It was a vulgar, flatulent song, and while a couple of the lower-class students applauded, I was impressed that many of the couples took that as their cue to get their pictures taken, or head to the punch bowl.
"Look at that,"
Brooke said, gazing up at the starry sky. Of course, it wasn't stars, but white Christmas lights stretched from basketball hoop to basketball hoop, sparkling, some blinking, creating unlikely new constellations high above us. I knew they were just Christmas lights, but I let the magic of the night wash over me and accept that we were in another world, one where a girl like Brooke McDaniels could love a guy like me. I looked around for my pal Jane, both because I wanted to tell her how well it was going and because I had never seen her in a dress. Turns out, she and Nick had already come and gone. I wanted to talk with her, but I guess they had what they wanted and felt no need to actually dance at the school dance. Some song I didn't know the name of by Montgomery Gentry began playing. While I wasn't really a devout country music fan, I was somewhere in between Jennifer and Errol, who loved and hated it, respectively. I swayed on the dance floor to it. Brooke asked if I ever went country dancing, and I had to admit that I hadn't.
"We'll have to go sometime,"
she said, lifting my spirits to the next plateau. Just how many were there up there?
"It's really fun."
Do I have to explain how mind-bendingly reassuring it was to hear her talk about potential future dates? Good.
"You want to dance?"
I asked, gesturing slightly.
"Sure,"
she said.
"But maybe we should get our pictures done while my hair's still tight."
I didn't know what she meant, but I put out my arm and she took it, the two of us walking toward the exit like royalty. In the hall, a tall, busty redhead, Carolina Keys, grabbed Brooke and let out a high-pitched squeal of delight.
"My gosh, Brooke, that dress is so great. Where did you get it?"
Brooke didn't answer, but squeezed my arm. "She made it," I said. "Made it herself."
"No,"
Carolina gasped.
"I got mine at D'Agostino's in Salt Lake. Don't you love it?"
It was blue-gray and covered with diamond-like sparkles, revealing more of her creamy white assets than anything you'd pick up in Utah County.
"Very nice,"
Brooke said, and I agreed, focusing on Carolina's eyes like my life depended on it. As we went to get our pictures, one 8x10 was free with each prom ticket, and you could pay extra for more, Brooke told me I was wrong about the dress.
You told me you were making it yourself when I asked you what color of tie to wear.
I know, but I thought you'd say something funny.
I didn't understand, but all well. Jennifer and Errol walked past us, on the way to get their own pictures taken. As we followed, I floated along down the hall, almost deliriously happy. I didn't see the finished result for almost 3 weeks. The developed pictures showed what everyone else could see. By the smile on my face, it's actually embarrassing in a cute sort of way. It was no secret what I thought of this particular evening. Or that part of it, anyway.
I'm gonna have to stop right there. I didn't realize how long the story is. Gosh, that's weird. I started out, I was talking about going to my childhood home today, and let me, include all of that talk, and then we will come back next time for the rest of the story, and then I'll talk about the story. The long episodes, but I can't see people being angry about long episodes. I can see them being more angry about short episodes. It's just me. Today I went to my childhood home. I went there yesterday as well, but we're trying to clear everything out. Eventually we're going to have to sell that place, and nobody wants to live there. And so the arduous task of emptying out the house is upon us. And not only is there the house, you know, there's the basement, there's the garage. There is what we called the tin garage growing up, which was where my dad kept all of his tools, and we kept the lawnmowers, and there was always a junker car in there that he had bought and hoped to fix up. And then we had the shed, which was new. I don't think the shed existed when I was living there. Just filled with all the boxes from those of us who had moved out of the house, which eventually became pretty much everyone. And then there was this thing called the Pink Palace. If I had to guess, I'd say it was about 1988. My dad bought a mobile home, but it wasn't mobile. Maybe it wasn't mobile at all. It was one of those prefab houses, and it wasn't new. It was old and falling apart. I don't know the whole story about it. I guess I'd have to ask where it came from, how we got it, and what the intention was when we got it. See, I grew up kind of on a farm with a big cow pasture, acres behind the house, and a big backyard, a barn, a chicken coop. Now there's a second chicken coop there. He had that many chickens. And we had a fenced-off section of the backyard where we kept sheep a couple of times, or my grandparents would get lambs, I guess, and we would raise them. And one year we got pigs. We tried pigs, but the pigs were just too smelly and too loud, and it was just gross, you know. I don't know that that's why we never did it again, but that's my thought. I remember you could smell the pigs just going out in the backyard. But anyhow, he got this corroding little prefab house back there, and it was pink, salmon colored, if I know what salmon is. And my mom hated it, and I don't know what the intention was for it, but after a while we just started putting junk in it, and it just collected junk and junk and junk. And when something would not be around, my mom would say, "We'll check the Pink Palace." That was a nickname she made for it, and it stuck. We all call it the Pink Palace now. Anyhow, when I moved away, when I moved to California, I still had my room in the basement. It was a big house, and the basement was unfinished, or whatever you want to call it. It was, with a cement floor and beams when we moved into the house. But little by little, the downstairs got developed. You know, like the first thing that got put in there was a washroom, you know, a washer and a dryer. And then we had a room where there was a freezer and like food storage, you know, tons of rice and cereal and things like that. And eventually they decided to build a bedroom down there for me. And eventually my sister got a bedroom down there. But yeah, but when I moved out to California, I had all of my stuff still in that childhood room. Then my sister had a kid, and it was decided that the kid would have that as her room. And so they packed up my stuff, and it went out to the Pink Palace. And I remember when I would come to visit, I would wonder what became of two things, mostly my Transformers and my Star Wars collection. Because around that time, you know, in the 90s, Star Wars stuff became really valuable. And in the, what it came after the 90s, 2000s, I guess, Transformers became really valuable. And so, you know, I always thought, oh, I've got one of those. And, oh, I wonder what became of those. And for all these years, I sort of resigned myself to the thought that either all of those toys were thrown away or they were stolen, because we did have a little bit of problem with that, people coming and breaking in to, not, it wasn't even broken into. I mean, it, the little town is one of those where people don't lock their doors. And, anyhow, we've been trying to clean out stuff, and my brother showed up there really, really early today. And I guess his task was to clean out the Pink Palace, and we didn't succeed entirely. It's just too great a job, you know, just dozens and dozens of boxes in every single room of this thing, including the bathroom, which never worked. I mean, there was never any water hooked up to the Pink Palace or anything like that. But anyhow, he uncovered a bunch of boxes, stuff that was mine from elementary school. My mom, I guess, had saved my papers and report cards and letters that I had written. I guess in 1983, I had written my uncle, Rex, asking him if he would buy me a Star Wars toy for Christmas, which is I had no memory of at all, but I did a drawing of the toy that I wanted so that it would help him find it if he went to the store. And that just blows my mind, because I have no good memories about him at all. He just, yeah, either I was insane, or at some point I felt close enough to him that I could ask him for something. Not that I got it. It's just weird. Anyhow, maybe my mom, saner heads prevailed, you know, and she didn't mail that letter, but the letter was there in the folder. Anyway, there were just boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff. Boxes from college, boxes from high school. And the time it would take to look through them all to decide what I wanted to keep and what I wanted to throw away is so daunting. Maybe you've experienced something like that. Maybe you have nothing that was saved from your childhood, which I understand most people can't afford to save junk. They just don't have space for it. But I was looking through a box from college today, and I had a bunch of newspaper articles that I had saved. Anytime there was a concert that I went to, I would save the newspaper article for that. Anytime there was a movie that I really loved that they did a write-up on, I would save that. Just that sort of stuff. And I read a couple of interviews that I had cut out, but for the most part, it was all garbage. I threw it away. I threw away the interviews after I read them. But I found some drawings that I had done. I found some printouts of stories and essays that I had done. And if the drawing was good, I kept it, but everything else I threw away. I ended up throwing away a lot of the papers, because it just, who cares, man? You know, you write an essay about something for a class. It doesn't matter. I found the title card that I made for a student film called Night of the Corn. And it wasn't even a student film. It was a series of scenes from a movie that didn't exist, a horror movie called Night of the Corn, like a, you know, kind of like the Sci-Fi Channel mix with those terrible, intentionally terrible movies. And tons of like movie posters. And those I didn't throw away, but I should. I will, eventually. It just, they were in boxes, you know, so they're not rolled or anything. I just would fold them up as best I could, and there they are. I read a bunch of notes that my screenwriting teacher wrote on my very first screenplay. And yeah, he gave it, you know, the highest grade possible, and which you would. I was the only person in that class to write a screenplay. Yeah, it was called screenwriting. Anyhow, the kids found some video cassettes, and my dad still had a VCR, working VCR, and so they put one in, and it was my sister, when she was a little kid, and her friends had made a video and of them just being silly or whatever, and that was fine. I mean, I didn't really watch it. I watched 10 seconds of it and kept asking my sister which one was her, which makes me sound like an old man, but I didn't recognize her. She looked nothing like herself. I guess it was when I was moved away, you know, during that time period that I didn't know her. Anyhow, my brother had found this box of Star Wars guys, and it was a big, big cardboard box. And I guess mice had gotten into it, so just the bottom of the box was just full of mouse droppings. And water, I guess, had gotten into it, and so the Star Wars ships had, I don't know if it's rust or just, there was some kind of brown stains all over everything, reddish brown, and it was, I don't want to say that it was heartbreaking. It was disappointing, but because I had chalked up for years those items as being lost or stolen, it couldn't hurt that much, because yesterday I had no old Star Wars toys at all from my childhood. And then today, you know, I had old Star Wars toys that might not have been in pristine condition. And so that was disappointing, but at the same time, hey, I've got those again and no place to put them. And I came in for like a towel or something. I was going to try and clean off one of them, see, you know, how easy or hard it was to get the red brown stains off. And my nephews had found, and my niece had found, a video cassette that had my name on it. And so they had put it in the VCR. And just as I walked in, Night of the Corn was playing. And I was bemused and horrified at the same time. And I watched it with them. And the editing was the thing that was the worst about it. There was just no way for me to edit in a professional or even semi-professional way on my own in those days. The only thing I could do was take the camera, hook it to a VCR, and press record on the VCR and press play on the camera. And to see that that's how I had edited it, it was all too clear. You know, there were all sorts of mistakes and problems and things that had made it through. But what else could I do? But boy, it was so strange to see myself from those days. I mean, A, I was super, super skinny. But two, my hair was so thick compared to now that it was remarkable to me. Carson, my brother-in-law's kid, kept asking how come I wasn't in the movie. And when he said that, I was like, that's me right there, the guy on the screen right now. I guess I was just unrecognizable. Oh, the other thing is, there was this girl, Christiane Morris, that lived in the apartment complex where we lived. And she was so beautiful that not only did I have a crush on her, but all the guys that came in contact with her had a crush on her. She was something else. And she was in that. And there was 15 seconds of her on that video. And I was like, oh, wow. I hadn't seen her in all these years, but it was neat to see that. My buddy Big made movies in college and high school, like I did. I think his always had more production values, and he had actually a way to edit. In fact, he had training on an Avid, a nonlinear computerized editing system, and was able to make things look insanely good. And so when he and I sort of first became friends, it was like, this is the guy you want to hang out with. This is the guy who can make your stuff look great, you know? And he had talked for years, and I don't know if he ever did it, about uploading a bunch of his student films to YouTube and just having them be out there. You know, you could watch the masterpieces that he made in those days. There's no way I would ever dare do it. I mean, but you know me, I won't do a video podcast now. But anyhow, it was so weird to see that. Plus, it was the same day that I'd found that title card. I have to admit that I've thrown away a ton of stuff. I mean, maybe the whole family are hoarders, you know, like you see on those shows. For my mom to have saved, and she had a folder for me for each of my grades of elementary school and something saved from them, you know, whether it was a letter from the teacher, a report card, or, you know, drawings or, you know, assignments. And she had done that for me. She had done that for my brother. She had done that for my sisters. So that's a lot of stuff. And then, yeah, all of our toys and stuffed animals and just that kind of junk was saved. And I found myself just throwing stuff away indiscriminately. There was a box that was just full of stuff that was important to me at one time. And I just tossed it all. It had like tons of audio cassettes and records and books and magazines and notes and notepads and all that. And I just, yeah, I threw away the entire box. I think I took out the photographs and everything else I threw away. And then afterward, I was just like, gosh, that was impulsive. That I wonder if there were some really treasured items in there. And the thing is, I could go through every single one of those boxes and find things that I would want to keep. But until I went through the box and discovered it, I would not know that those things existed anymore. The same way as like with the Transformers and the Star Wars guys. Out of sight, out of mind. And then once I see it, it's just like, ooh. But ooh doesn't last very long. I mean, truthfully, what on earth would I do with that stuff? So, yeah, I read my teacher's notes on my screenplay. And then I tossed it. And yeah, there were tons of like comic strips I had cut out of the newspaper. Things that I thought were funny as a kid. But I haven't looked at that stuff in 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. Throw it away. All of the posters that I had hanging on my walls, like when I was in college or in high school or junior high school or elementary school, throw it away. Right? I mean, downstairs at this place, I have 15 poster tubes just filled with posters and almost as many poster frames that have posters in them. And they just sit. They're all in a stack. And why do I keep them? I guess in the back of my mind, it's like, well, one day I will have a house and I can put them up. But am I really going to want to put up a poster that was important to me in, you know, 2001, in 1998, in 1992, in 1988, you know, that kind of stuff? Shoot, I was going to share a story. At this point, it's too late. What I should do is have all this stuff be at the end of an episode and then re-record so that I have an opportunity. I'm tempted to have this be an episode about the Brown Prom. Oh, one more thing that I found in one of those boxes today was the corsages from my senior and junior prom. I saved those. Wait, is the corsage what the boy has? The boy buys a corsage for the girl, right? And the girl buys a boutonniere for the boy. Is that? I don't know if that's right or not. But I hopefully you know what I'm talking about. The male equivalent, the flower that you pin to the lapel of the guy's suit or tux. And I had saved those all these years in the little plastic cases that they came in. And the plastic cases are there for you to save forever, right? Because, yeah, they still looked like flowers. You could tell what they were supposed to be. They had not rotted and turned into dust or anything like that. I threw them away. I mean, I didn't even spare 2 seconds looking at them, but there they were. So now the question is, do I record the Brown Prom and have this be an episode about it? And in which case I should talk about it right now, Or do I turn this off, look at the Brown Prom, see what shape it's in, and decide whether to record it? Do I just sit down and record Brown Prom and then immediately after turn this thing back on so that I have something to say about it? Yeah, I think that's the one. That's the way to go. There are differences, of course. Yes, our school, and maybe your school did too, had this big thing about elaborate askings or invitations to prom. And the more out of your way you went, or the more creative you were about it, you know, the more cachet you had. And also, the girl, Brooke McDaniels, is based on a girl that I knew in high school and didn't know her very well. She was so beautiful that I was super intimidated. And yeah, that is par for the course. But the thing that makes this kind of unique is that one time I did build up the courage to ask her out. And this was in the summer. It wasn't for prom. And she said yes. And we actually went. We went to a comedy club together and a restaurant. And I just, I hadn't thought of that in so long. I want to say that I hadn't thought about it in 15 years or 20 years. But clearly I had thought about it when I wrote this story. And then I finished just this week the story, 10,000 Coffins. And I based the main character of that story on this same girl. And in thinking about her, I remembered that she went with me to that comedy club. And yeah, she had no interest in me romantically. But she thought I was funny, and she saw that I was nice. And so there was that. There are other little aspects of the story that are true. God, I took this girl out one time, and her dad had told her brother, her little brother, to answer the door and tell me that their dad had a gun. And it used to be that when I would tell the story, and I would tell them of the little boy saying, "My daddy told me to tell you he has a gun," people would laugh. But I find it the opposite of funny now. It's so not funny now. It's just, it's shitty is what it is. And there are lots of that overprotective, good old boy dad crap that people find charming, but it isn't. It isn't charming. It sucks. Thing is, I've written a bunch of these stories about high school, about teenagers. I tend not to share most of them because they feel private to me. They feel personal. Hopefully, that's not bothersome. Yeah, let me know if this is something that you enjoyed, if you'd like to hear more of them, because boy, there are more. And I don't know if my buddy Rhett ever heard this story, but I ought to send it to him. Because, yeah, he was always a fan of my writing. And if you're a fan of my writing, feel free to subscribe to my Patreon feed. And, oh, I just realized I should put a link to the Patreon feed in every single podcast episode. But thank you again, people who subscribe, people who give me money. There's not a lot of you, but the advantage of that is that I appreciate each and every one of you. I really do. You're good people. Someday I'll make it up to you. Good night.
The podcast you have just listened to was produced under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Share it while you still have the chance. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com for the music so inexpertly used in this episode.
Are you insulting him or me?
You.
Good evening. This is Rish Outfield.
And this is Sir Fake Sean Connery. And you're listening to, say it with me, lad,
the podcast
that dares not speak its name.
Not a lot of episodes of this show.
Too many, if you ask me.
I didn't.
That's adorable.
Yeah, so we will be back for the rest of the Brown Prom, and I feel bad about the warning, because it wasn't necessary yet. So we can cut that out, I suppose. In fact, I'll put the warning in the second half.
Brooke drove her Suzuki Samurai.
We like ourselves, don't we?
Today, before closing, and pull to the drive-thru, ask to speak to Ronald, your pal, Grimace. What a stupid voice. Why did I do it in that voice? Because you haven't read this story in 10 years.
I was in between Jennifer and Errol, who loved and hated it, respectfully. I was in between Jennifer. I'm going to say somewhere. I was somewhere in between Jennifer and Errol, who loved it, who loved and hated it, who loved and hated it, respectively.
It's a sweet story. It's a somber. I can't remember what word I'm looking for. I just started to fall asleep while I was recording this. What would be funny is if I was silent for like 3.5 minutes. I have had that happen before. I've been editing audiobooks. And then my voice goes right there. And then there's silence for 3 minutes or something like that. Wonderful. At least I have an outtake now.